officer politely asked me to step aside. Within a few seconds, a plainclothes security official escorted me to another corridor where a station officer greeted me. There was no immigration stamp, no record of my being in the country, nothing. I had always heard that the CIA and the host government had a close relationship. I also understood that, for the first time, I had just been officially declared to a foreign government as a CIA officer. There was nothing ceremonious, just a nod from an immigration official. The hotel was 5-star, and, as my COS had predicted, the food excellent. I had never stayed in such luxury. Usually, when on the road, I bunked in a simple lodge that I hoped had a working fan and a mosquito net with no holes. Unexpected luxury notwithstanding, the mission looked like a bust. Local liaison reported that the target had not arrived with her delegation. So I visited the station in the morning to read, then worked out at the hotel gym during the afternoon. On the fourth day, she showed. Local liaison had placed her under static and mobile surveillance. With CIA technology, vehicles, training, and funding, this service was top of the line. They bird-dogged her every move and placed me in perfect position for a chance encounter. She took a couple of seconds to remember me, then nodded and almost smirked. I provided her a blatantly lame excuse for being in town. She understood what was happening, if she had not before. She was no dummy, but her curiosity and confidence apparently trumped any worry. She accepted my invitation for a cup of tea, and we moved to a nearby cafe. "How long are you in town?" she asked. "Well, that depends. How long are you here?" I answered. She stifled a laugh that turned into a cough. "Only a couple of days," she answered, catching her breath and wiping her eyes with a napkin. At least I offered her some mild amusement, I thought. After a brief and polite discussion of families, the conversation turned to politics. The frank exchange exceeded the 45 minutes that local liaison had predicted, given her schedule. After almost an hour, she accepted a name and phone number to call when she next traveled outside her country. During the next 2 years, she never called. She did show up in another country, where again the local liaison service spotted her on a visitor's list. She would be there for a couple of months. Instead of flying there, however, I wrote her a letter of introduction to a colleague, an ops officer assigned to the local station. He would seek to resume the assessment and development of this delightful senior foreign official. The officer and the target had a good first meeting when he gave her my letter. They had another meeting, then another. As is often the case, I never learned the outcome of the operation. I will never know. I did not need to know. Over the course of 6 years, 3 liaison services on 3 continents had helped us track and pursue this otherwise unilateral target. Maybe with their help, she eventually agreed. I suspect that she did. I hope so. Mason. As he turned to close the door of his car, his massive back and shoulders stretched the fabric of his suit coat. That was the first thing I noticed when I met him. His torso looked like an NFL linebacker's. As he turned to shake hands, his deep-set eyes flickered from me to the pleasant residential surroundings. He looked back at me and blinked slowly. His thick hand grasped mine in a soft handshake. He nodded and smiled. He had yellow teeth. His close-cropped haircut seemed to accentuate his huge, bullet-shaped head. Mason would be my primary liaison partner for the next 3 years. I invited him to join me for hot black tea on the thatch-covered patio overlooking our residential garden. We politely reviewed the history of our liaison relationship, one of the most productive on the continent. This cooperation was based on the mutual threats our countries faced from Iran, North Korea, Libya, and other nations. Emerging transnational terrorist groups also pose danger to the citizens of both of our countries. The CIA and the local service needed each other. The CIA had vast resources, and this service had huge needs. The CIA had global reach, and this service had intimate knowledge of the country and the region. The local service had a cadre of solid officers, many of them survivors of a harsh guerrilla war. Those less bright and less adaptable had perished. The smarter and tougher ones, the survivors, now ran the country and the service. Mason was a prime example. As we wrapped up the initial agenda, I asked Mason about his personal history. He had participated in the insurrection from an early age. I knew that and more from our file on him, but I wanted a better sense of his self-regard. He seemed at ease, even enjoying our discussion, as I was. "What about that scar on your forearm?" I asked. Earlier he had taken off his suit and rolled up his sleeves, revealing massive forearms. On his left was a lettered inscription in the form of ridged scars. He looked at his arm and raised it slightly. "That is the acronym of our guerrilla army." I knew that. "Yes, but how did you acquire the scar?" Mason pursed his thick lips. He was not looking at me, apparently pondering how much he should tell me. "I was separated from my patrol. Some of us were killed, others captured. I was alone. If I didn't make it, I wanted them to know. I wanted them to know who I was." "You carved those initials yourself?" I asked. "Yes." "So if captured or killed, there would be no doubt about your affiliation?" "Yes." What could I say to that? Everything else seemed inconsequential. Mason, sitting there with his guerrilla identity carved into his flesh, now looked at me. Not angry, not embarrassed, just relaxed. "Would you like some more tea?" I asked. "Yes, please." For the next 3 years, in collaboration with Mason's team, our station ran multiple technical collection and surveillance operations against a host of targets. We provided gear, cash, and training, with a mandatory section on human rights. They provided physical access, manpower, and political cover. We jointly produced hundreds of intelligence reports. We also participated in joint recruitment operations of foreign targets. Sometimes their officers would make the pitch, sometimes ours. Usually the recruited sources had no idea their information was going to both the CIA and the local service. In one case, a state sponsor of terrorism had launched a delegation of senior officials throughout Asia and Africa. As part of a broader CIA plan to recruit sources and disrupt the activities of this enemy state, HQS directed several stations to gain access to a specific delegate as he passed through these various capitals. This directive launched a flurry of cables among the stations as each jockeyed for a shot at the moving target. He was only in each country for a couple of days, so the window of opportunity was limited. We watched as each station along the way missed its chance. Then the target arrived in our little part of the world, with our liaison partners waiting. They wrapped him in surveillance. We plotted and projected his movements, waiting for the right venue, the right opportunity to make the approach. Mason's deputy, George, directed the surveillance teams, and he recommended the site. He masterfully orchestrated a separation of the target from the other delegates in a public area, like cutting a single cow from the herd. With George at my flank, about 5 feet away and looking in the direction of the other delegates, I confronted the target. "Hi, I'm Frank," I said as I extended my hand. He stepped back, recovered, muttered his name, and we shook hands. "I am a U.S. intelligence official. We want you to cooperate with us. You are a decent man, but with your current regime, you have no future, you know that.
Who are you?
He stammered.
You know who I am.
You need us. Without us, you have nothing. Take this letter. Read and remember the instructions. Then destroy the document. Call us the next time you are out of the country.
He took the letter. I couldn't believe it.
Do you understand? I asked.
I don't know you. Please go away.
He shoved the letter in a pocket. We know you. We know what you do. We know your friends. You want to be a part of the filthy, murdering regime you call a government? You have a choice, a real choice, with us.
He cringed and nodded, perhaps more in fear than agreement. He was about to lose it, and I was out of time. George's men could not stall the other delegates any longer. I could go no further.